Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Harry Smith of NBC News, and this is On Point. Knee high by the 4th of July, they say, about Iowa's acres and acres of corn. Soybeans stretching as far as the eye can see. But that emerald expanse comes at a cost. Takes a lot of fertilizer, chemicals, to keep big ag business a big business. And a new study shows Hawkeye State farmers send more than their fair share of nitrates into the Gulf of Mexico, contributing to a huge ecological dead zone that last summer was the biggest on record, raising big questions about water quality, regulations, and the environment. This hour, On Point, Iowa's water quality goes south. You can join us on air or online. Iowa listeners, farmers everywhere, is this a problem where you live? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Iowa City, Iowa, is Chris Jones, a hydrologist and research engineer at the University of Iowa. He's the co-author of a recent study about nitrogen pollution flowing out of Iowa and into the Gulf of Mexico, and you can find that on our website at onpointradio.org. Chris Jones, welcome to On Point.
Yeah, thank you, Harry.
Really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. Were you surprised at your findings?
Well, not entirely, no. There are some things that were a surprise. We looked at nitrate loading from Iowa to the three major river basins, that being the Missouri River, the Upper Mississippi River, and the Mississippi River at the outlets at the Gulf of Mexico. And our loading to the Missouri River is probably the most surprising thing about our data. We show that in some years, Iowa delivers up to 89% of the nitrate to the Missouri River, even though our land area is only 3.3% of the Missouri River basin.
That's amazing.
At the Gulf of Mexico, we have about 4.5% of the land area. We provide 5.9% of the water and about 29% of the nitrate. And so another surprising thing, I think, about our data is over the last 20 years or so, it would appear that nitrate loading to the Gulf of Mexico actually would be declining about 42,000 tons per year, were it not for Iowa's contribution. Once we add Iowa into the equation, the nitrate load at the Gulf is actually increasing a little bit more than 50,000 tons per year. And so this would imply that what's happening here in Iowa is somehow different than what's happening across the rest of these watersheds. And so we look at crop areas, for example, being an important factor here. Crop areas in Iowa have only increased 4% since 1999, but about 21% across the entire Corn Belt. And so we always look to weather as being a component here, but it does not appear that weather is driving this, because the discharge from Iowa, discharge being river flow, is trending about the same as the rest of these other major basins.
Because of the climate changing, we have sometimes these sort of enormous thunderstorms that, for instance, outside of Des Moines just a few weeks ago dumped enormous amounts of rain at one time. But you don't think that's a factor in this?
Certainly more rain means more water pollution, no matter what we're looking at, whether it's nitrate or something else. When we look at what controls levels of a pollutant in our streams, such as nitrate, we talk about transport considerations and supply limit considerations. And so the transport considerations, of course, would include rainfall and drainage, and the supply considerations would be, of course, in the case of nitrate, inputs of nitrogen,
right,
from our ag industry, and then soil processes and things of that nature.
Sure.
And so,
do we know where the nitrates come from? Because so much of this, as this conversation has gone on, and I've been paying considerable amount of attention to this over the last couple of years, it's about nitrates in the form of fertilizers. But you have this enormous amount of animals in buildings and on the ground in Iowa. Is that, could that also be a contributing factor?
Well, we suspect it is in these areas draining to the Missouri. Of course, it's very difficult to delineate where the nitrate comes from, the nitrate in a stream, whether you can trace it back to manure or commercial fertilizer or soil processes or what have you. That's not something we can do very easily.
Yeah.
But at any rate, we know that prior to European settlement, we have about 7 to 8 times as much nitrate in our streams here in Iowa. And
wow.
So we can't necessarily track it to any one thing. It's
yeah.
just every it's everything.
Let me get to this, though, because there's been a considerable statewide effort to curb this nitrate pollution. Lots of money has been spent. Is there your sense that the conservation efforts are not working?
Well, I wouldn't say that. When we put in a wetland, for example, mm-hmm. we know that that wetland is going to work. And there's other practices that we do on the landscape that the existing scientific literature shows that, you know, they work. The problem is the scale at which we do things here is so enormous. And so we have, oh, I think about 26 million crop acres in Iowa. And the amount of conservation and the amount of practices that we need to reach our water quality goals are really very, very large compared to what we've implemented thus far.
Right. And let's talk about then this end product. It'd be a surprising number of people are not aware that a dead zone seems to form every summer in the Gulf of Mexico. Last year was the biggest on record. It was bigger than the state of New Jersey. Talk a little bit about the dead zone and what transpires there.
Well, these nutrients from the Corn Belt get down to the Gulf, and they catalyze algae blooms in the Gulf. And, of course, these algae have been around since the dawn of time, but when we increase these levels of nitrogen and phosphorus and other things in our waters, we greatly enhance the likelihood of these blooms and the magnitude of these blooms. And so when these organisms bloom in the Gulf of Mexico and they die, bacteria consume their remains, and during that process, oxygen is depleted in the Gulf of Mexico, and of course that leaves conditions unsuitable for the native species there, shrimp, fish, what have you. And so this is a big ecological problem, not just here in North America, but other places around the world as well.
Yeah, there's dead zones in a lot of different places, especially mm-hmm. huge one in the Middle East, as it turns out. Mm-hmm. What was the reaction from the agriculture community when your study was released?
Well, I think a lot of people really believe that this is a weather-driven phenomenon. And when we look at stream nitrate, there's no doubt that the year-to-year variations in nitrate levels correlate with weather. There's no doubt about that. But then to make this next leap and say that this is caused by weather is not really logical. As I say, we increase the supply of nitrogen on the landscape, and we have extreme weather in Iowa. We're in the middle of a continent, and so by virtue of that, we're going to have extreme weather where we get a lot of rain one year and not a lot of rain the next year. And So we really need to design our systems so that we can endure these wild swings in the weather. And so, yes, we have correlation with weather, but when we increase the supply of a pollutant on the landscape, especially if that pollutant is water-soluble,
yeah,
it just stands to reason we're going to get more of it in our streams when it rains.
Hand in hand, for sure. For people who are listening and maybe not familiar with this issue, here's reporter David Biello in a 2016 piece for the PBS NewsHour describing the scope of the problem in Iowa.
Corn is king here, grown mostly for animal feed and ethanol. Corn doesn't like to have its feet wet. And to keep the fields dry, pipes have been installed to drain water off the fields. And with that water goes the fertilizer. Fertilizer laden with nitrate. Nitrate is a dangerous chemical in drinking water. It stops oxygen from entering the human bloodstream.
And if you're an old farmer like me, the pipes that you put in the ground, we call that tiling. Give us a little description of what exactly happens. So the nitrate's applied as the water goes through the land. It's almost like a drainage system underneath the soil that takes this water and nitrate infused water where?
So yes, we have probably well in excess of 1 million miles of tile in Iowa.
Wow.
And maybe a lot more than that. We don't really know how much there is, but of course, when Europeans got here, Iowa was wet prairie and wetland. And to maximize crop yields, we need to drain the land and lower the water table. And really, we know, and we've known for a long, long time, that this tile is the primary delivery mechanism for nitrate getting from fields to streams. And so farmers will put tile down at 30 or 60 foot spaces to drain their fields.
Yeah. Chris Jones, stay with us. We're discussing Iowa's water quality and the nitrate pollution that flows into the Gulf of Mexico. You can join the conversation. Iowa, are you feeling the effects in your drinking water? Farmers, is there too much red tape for you to try to do something about all of this? I'm Harry Smith. And this is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
There's a new way to hear Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and all your favorite programs. Just ask your smart device to play NPR. Listen to your local station anytime, like this. Hey, smart device, play NPR.
This is On Point. I'm Harry Smith from NBC News. We're talking about Iowa's water pollution problem and the impact that's felt all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. You can join the conversation if you're downstream from Iowa. Are you feeling this? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Chris Jones, a hydrologist at the University of Iowa, who has just authored a study about nitrate pollution that flows down the Missouri and Mississippi rivers and into the Gulf of Mexico. And joining us now also from Cushing, Iowa, is Cheryl Johnson, a farmer who grows corn, soybeans, and alfalfa, and also raises purebred cattle. She joined us last year on the On Point Listening Tour in Ames. And Cheryl Johnson, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Harry. Thank you for having me.
Talk to me a little bit about this as a concern. Where is this on your radar, nitrate pollution?
I believe it's a huge concern for most anybody who's in agriculture production. Myself, just listening to Chris here a little bit ago and talking about the tiling, it reminded me that, you know, this spring I had to dig up some tiling, and as I was digging up tiling, right beside the most recent tiling was the old cement tiling that nobody knew even existed. And without digging up the entire field, I don't know where that's coming from. You know, my fields have terraces, broad-based terraces, with tiling up, you know, to those terrace inlets. So I think that, you know, the majority of us who are landowners, farmers, it's a huge concern. I'll use myself and also as an example. When Chris brought up the 26 million acres of farm ground, I rent farm ground also. Now, as a landowner, I do like to and I appreciate the value, and I know and I've realized the added benefits to cover crops. But the land that I rent, because you're on a year-to-year basis with those landowners, it's hard to get them to see long-term what the effects of cover crops can do. And therefore, you know, you can't, out of that 26 million acres, if half of that is owned by, you know, non-participating landowners, it's hard for us to control that. So those of us who are truly farmers get a bad rap, and that does concern me when we really are concerned about it.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll give an example. In the last 5 years, from the very first cover crop meeting that I went to, which was basically attended by mostly USDA employees, to last year I attended one, and the turnout was phenomenal. So I think that people are seeing the importance of the cover crops to help with the nitrate problem.
Because they help in a lot of holding the soil together, enabling the little living things that like to live underneath growing things. You should explain it a little bit, because what happens in a farm field, say you've got a soybean field, you can actually go over when the crop is, you know, fairly mature, almost ready to harvest, and plant, say, ryegrass or something that ends up several inches tall right after the soybeans are harvested, and suddenly you have a field of green that exists through the wintertime that can withstand all kinds of pressures.
Correct. And not only that, what you just mentioned about the benefits of what it does for opening up the soil and letting more oxygen into the soil, which is better for the roots of our plants. But then you do turn around and you do have, for instance, say that rye that you can either harvest, you can graze it as a cattle producer.
Yeah.
There are other benefits to it. It's just hard for people to change, you know. But then I'm going to also go back to when you are a tenant, it's hard to convince the landowner that, okay, I'm going to do this now, that beans are there, I'm going to harvest, but there's going to be another crop growing up. Well, that's not the norm, because most of those people are 65 years old. Or older.
Yeah.
You know? So.
Do you get a sense from the folks who are renting the ground? I mean, could some of the things that have been talked about in order to help, you know, curb this nitrate spread is just even simple crop rotation. Back in the day, you know, when I first came into Iowa in the 1960s, it wasn't just corn and soybeans. There were oats. There was a big oat crop in Iowa way back in the day. The folks who are renting the ground, do they care about things like crop rotation or stripping, putting grass strips in fields, the kinds of things that will help curb the nitrate spread?
Oh, yeah. I think the majority of us, I'm going to say I think we all do, because there's nothing I hate worse than seeing the monsoon rains come and wash everything out of the field. And I know when I, you know, as a tenant and a landowner myself, when I know other people who are in the same position, they don't want to see their nitrate, because that's money washing away, you know. So, and even if I drove across eastern Iowa and all the flooded out areas where you could see the drain tiles sticking up, you know, those farmers, that's lost income, that's lost inputs, that's, you know, that hurts their family, their living.
Do farmers need help with this? Do they? The state of Iowa, you know, has a budget for this of some hundreds of millions of dollars. Is this the state's responsibility, or is it the federal government's responsibility, or should farmers be taking more responsibility?
Well, I think there are a large number of farmers that do take this very seriously. Again, I've said that over and over,
yeah.
But there is help. There is equip programs. You just have to implement. I do know that there are some people that have said, you know, there's red tape that you have to go through. I found nothing but more than willing and able people from the conservation office to help explain. And in fact, they are they encourage everyone to use cover crops. So is there, I also think the large farmers, there are large farmers out there that don't take the time and waste their time, they would say, to go in and go through the quit process and signing up for programs because they're too busy and they just do it. And so therefore they don't get credit for it, whether it be, cover crops or the waterways, headlands, whatever it
might be. Cheryl, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on
yes.
Point today. Sure appreciate your input.
Well, thank you.
You bet. We got a lot of good calls this morning. Kevin is calling from Lutherville, Maryland. Kevin?
Hi, Harry. This is Kevin. The reason I'm calling in is it has to do with the nitrate runoff, but, really, it's not a simple process. And like your last caller, she talks about how, concerned she is being a farmer, and I think that's true for most of our farmers and most of our poultry and livestock growers, our producers in the country. I think they're very concerned because certainly they don't, they are husbands of the land. I think one of the things that we need to be concerned about, certainly here in Maryland, we have to be concerned about coordination, interstate coordination. We have issues with Pennsylvania that are at the headwaters of the Chesapeake Bay. And as you know, the Chesapeake Bay is the largest estuary in the United States. And it has had tremendous problems, such as you talked about with the Gulf of Mexico with dead spots. We have had restoration efforts that have increased the grasses in the Chesapeake Bay, which have helped it tremendously. We have conservation efforts with Virginia and with Maryland dealing with runoff. We tried to introduce BAT technology, best known technology for septic systems and things of that nature, which unfortunately failed in this state. But really, this is just not a simple process. We have people. We have to feed these people. We have to produce these people. And so it has to be, in my mind, an effort that is highly coordinated, which really brings us back to regulation. And I know that's difficult to deal with, but we do have an EPA.
Yeah.
What we're seeing, with our weather issues that I believe Chris brought up a while back is that we have to implement programs to deal with these things, but our weather is just getting worse and worse. And I think we can directly relate it, if we're logical, to
right.
How we treat the environment.
Gotcha.
So no real question, but just a statement.
Understood. Thank you very much, Kevin. Elena is calling from Akron, Ohio, and I've seen some of the pictures from what I think you want to talk about, and that is the bloom that happens in Lake Erie, which is stunning to see from the air. Elena, how are you today?
Hi, Harry. How are you doing?
Good.
I'd like to talk about the north a little bit.
Yeah, please.
The water, Lake Erie is supposedly the most, the largest freshwater in the world, and they're ruining it. The water runoff from the, the agriculture, it's a mess. It's a mess. It needs to be fixed. And Governor Kasich is running away from it. And what do I say? You got to fix it.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about the South. We're talking about the Mississippi going south to the Gulf. Lake Erie, please.
Gotcha. Elena, thank you so much. Call from Akron, Ohio. I want to introduce Art Cullen, Pulitzer Prize-winning editor of the Storm Lake Times up at Storm Lake, Iowa, northwest Iowa. We appreciate your time. How are you doing today, Art?
Fine, thanks, Harry. Go Beavers.
Go Beavers. That's the Buena Vista University there in Storm Lake, arch rival of Central College in Pella, where I matriculated some years back. Art, I want to talk to you about what your paper has worked on so hard over the last dozen years or so, and how you came head to head with Big Ag. Let's talk about the nature of the farms that I saw when I first came out to Iowa in the 1960s. Farms that were a quarter section. There'd be corn, there'd be soybeans, but there'd be lots of hedges there. There'd be pasture for animals to graze on. There'd be some hogs. There might even be some sheep. There were lots of hedges built in. What do those farms look like now?
Well, as you referred to, a quarter section, 360 acres.
Sorry.
That farm doesn't exist anymore. Today, farms, you know, a common farm size in Iowa, a row crop operation, a corn-soybean rotation, is typically 1,000 to 2,000 acres. These are not family farms anymore, per se. They're family farm corporations. And that's been made necessary since 1980, since the farm crisis. There's been a lot of consolidation in Iowa agriculture. It used to be a state of small farms and small livestock operations, and now it's much larger farms that specialize in row crop production. And then large meat packing companies have vertically integrated in the meat industry. So we have these huge hog and turkey houses and chicken houses pocked around the landscape that do provide a significant amount of manure to the landscape, which is now showing up in phosphorus loads in Sailorville Reservoir, from which Des Moines draws its drinking water, and they're seeing toxic algae blooms in Sailorville, and that serves about 500,000 drinking water consumers in the Des Moines metro area, similar to Lake Erie, where they serve about 500,000 consumers around Toledo. The fields today, we're plowing through the fence lines into the ditches, and we're even plowing. I have photos of farmers plowing into state-owned lake banks and planting soybeans in the lake bed, dried-up lake beds.
Part of this is this notion we have, you know, almost that sort of Grant Wood notion, that kind of Iowa Gothic view of folks who live on the farm and as them being stewards of the land. And when I hear you talk about what you just said, that's really pretty much the opposite.
Yeah, corporate agribusiness runs this state, and whether you're talking about Monsanto or Koch Fertilizer or Dow DuPont, and there's a very tightly woven ag supply chain that dominates industrial agriculture in Iowa and Illinois. And so we're very tightly woven into that, and it's not the fault of the farmer per se, but because of the consolidation that's occurred since 1980, in fact, it's been occurring since 1920, actually, but the pace has accelerated in the last 30 years. Those quarter sections you referred to are now vacant farmhouses, or they were bowled over to plant corn, and we're planting corn on every square inch, because when your previous guest had to pay $250 to $300 an acre cash rent, you got to plant on every square inch to get that $3 corn off it.
I want to get Chris Jones back in here a second, Art, the hydrologist from the University of Iowa who penned this new study.
You bet.
Chris, we're going to let you go in a minute or two, but if you have some final thoughts to share with us here with just a couple minutes left in this section.
Sure. So I think amongst the general public, you know, there's this instinct to sort of tie this back to individual farmers, and I think that's a mistake, as Art implied there. We have a system here. And so in some ways, these farmers are really tied to this system, you know, with not a lot of options. And so they could try growing something else. And as you said, oats, for example, or some other crop. But, you know, to do that here, you've got to have some place to sell it. And you need a market for that. And so we have this whole built infrastructure set up to support this corn-soybean system. And so, you know, if we're going to solve this pollution problem, we're going to have to look at the system itself. You know, can we make the system work and produce environmental outcomes that we want? And so I think that's an open-ended question, not so much from a science perspective, but from this whole socioeconomic perspective. Are we willing to pay to continue what we're doing with this corn-soybean system and get the environmental outcomes that we want? Because we know here in Iowa, this is a multi-billion dollar problem. And so it's a tough nut to crack for sure.
I think you got that right. Chris Jones, a hydrologist at the University of Iowa, we thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. Art, stay right where you are. We're discussing water pollution in Iowa and beyond. You can join the conversation. How does the climate change factor into this? And what about the economic impact on fisheries in the Gulf? I'm Harry Smith. This is On Point.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of the TED Radio Hour. In our latest episode, we're exploring the causes and consequences of hatred, what makes it such a powerful force, and why some people feel its pull more deeply. Take a listen to the TED Radio Hour on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Harry Smith from NBC News. We're talking about Iowa's water quality and pollution problem. You can join the conversation. Should a solution be left up to the legislature, individual farmers, the federal government? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're speaking with Art Cullen, the editor of the Storm Lake Times in rural northwest Iowa. And joining me now via Skype from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is Gene Turner, a professor of oceanography and coastal sciences at Louisiana State University. He's an expert on the hypoxic area of the Gulf that's commonly known as the dead zone. Gene Turner, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Harry. Thank you for inviting me.
Does you have a sense that the dead zone will be as big as last year or maybe not quite as bad?
It'll be about average for the last 20 or 30 years, which is still about three times larger than the target, and which is larger than it was anyhow around 1940. So it'll be dependent upon if there's a storm or not and a few things we haven't quite experienced yet. But it's hard to predict exactly the number, but we can generally rely upon the size depending on the nitrogen content in the river in May.
There you go. It's all about the nitrogen content. Describe what happens to the fish and plants in the dead zone.
Well, as Chris described it, the fertilization of the surface waters creates more algae of various kinds, which fall through the water to the bottom, sometimes by organisms that eat them. And they decompose mostly on the bottom, and the water structure is colder and saltier on the bottom and warmer and fresher on the top. So this keeps oxygen from keeps oxygen from the atmosphere from going down to the bottom because it's stratified. So the oxygen gets to a point at which organisms start to leave, and that it gets low enough, they'll actually die in the bottom. So mobile organisms like shrimp and fish will leave. And so they call it in the lay literature, in the newspapers, the dead zone, because they can't really catch anything.
Gotcha.
But there are, of course, things down there like bacteria and worms and a few other things.
Gotcha. This dead zone is a concern. We talked to someone who was on Chesapeake Bay. We talked to people who live near Lake Erie. Meg is calling from Sarasota, Florida. Meg?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to point out we're pretty far down the Gulf Coast, but we are affected as well. We have terrible red tide. It's this particular one has bloomed off and on since October. It has a tremendous impact on fish kills, manatee kills, turtle kills. It limits fishing. It impacts the beach and boating activity. And I have no respiratory problems such as asthma, emphysema, COPD, but I choke. I cough till I choke. It is such an irritant in the air with the red tide bloom puts off the gas that it emits. It irritates your eyes, your throat, your nose. It's horrible.
Meg, thanks very much for your input. I also want to play another piece of tape. This is Doug Gross, who is the legal counsel for the Agribusiness Association of Iowa. And in 2016, he told the PBS NewsHour about the tension this water pollution fight has created.
This is like a prairie fire in Iowa, in that we haven't seen anything like this for a long time, where one component of the state is really directly challenging the most important industry in our state, and has been since the founding of the state of Iowa, which is agriculture.
Art Cullen from the Storm Lake Times, does it feel like a prairie fire?
Well, if it is, Doug Gross started it. He lit the match. The Agribusiness Association of Iowa marshaled more than $1.4 million in secret dark money to fight a lawsuit on behalf of our county board of supervisors. And it was all done in secret.
Let me give a little context for this, because the Des Moines Water Works sued the drainage districts of three counties upstate from Des Moines because they were spending so much money to pull the nitrates out of the water. The counties really didn't have money to fight the suit. And how much money was raised, Art?
Well, we know that at least $1.4 million was raised following a meeting with executives from Koch Fertilizer and Monsanto. It was basically a bottomless well to make sure that the way of doing business in Iowa was not interrupted. And we were able, through our little newspaper, through a series of editorials, to stop those contributions into this federal lawsuit, because nobody knew where they were coming from. For the record, we actually did find out that Monsanto and Koch were involved. But they want to preserve what they've got going here. And if Iowa falls, Ohio falls, and Illinois falls, this is ground zero. And so in that respect, Doug Gross is right. But by refusing to even discuss these issues with the Des Moines Water Works, they invited the lawsuit. And so that's why I say they lit the match.
You know, it's interesting because on one hand, we're talking with Gene Turner, who knows all about the effects of this nitrate pollution that goes down into the Gulf of Mexico. But you have plenty of people in Iowa who wonder, you know, every day just how much of this nitrate is going into their water supply, especially in Des Moines. That's a 500,000 customers. There are a lot of other people around the state who are wondering if it's going into the groundwater that supplies water from aquifers.
Or why the three smartest farmers I know all suffer from neurological disorders, Parkinson's disease, MS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, all 2,000-acre chemical farmers.
Do you have a sense that Iowa has a handle on this? Or, you know, we were talking to Cheryl a little while ago, and she says, you know, when they were first talking about cover crops a couple of years ago, there were very few people there, and now the place is crowded. Do you sense a change in attitude?
Well, I think there's a recognition that climate change actually is impacting agriculture. And yes, there is an increased level of interest we see at events like Practical Farmers of Iowa, which is a resilient or sustainable ag group. And you do see large crowds there. And 20 years ago, they were thought of as farmer freaks. But today you are getting some crowds. Yet, the cover crop, you know, has gone from 100,000 acres to 600,000 in 5 years. And I'd say that's not much. And I still see farmers plowing up ditches and plowing into the Raccoon River, planting soybeans up to the Raccoon River, and they get flooded out every year. And there's crop insurance to protect their adventurism. And also another thing to consider is that we've increased our drainage capacity by 30% since 1980 because of increased rains. The increased drainage that's resulting in this flotsam down the Mississippi is a direct result of climate change plus agricultural consolidation. And so it's a very big force to reckon with, and it's a huge economic force and a special interest that's not easily unwoven.
Gene Turner you're down there catching all of this. Do you have a sense some days that you just wish you could say enough already?
What time of day is it? There's some commonalities here, one of which is that, in a way, we're both both ends of the pipe, so to speak, are both traditional resource users, and we both want to have some traditional way of living. And so it's not a them or us issue. We are at the end of the pipe, but also the water quality problems are at both ends of the pipe. The organisms that are responding to these nitrates and also phosphorus and other things are ones that evolved a long time ago, and trying to predict the behavior of when you get these new concentrations is like trying to predict teenager behavior in detail. You can't do it. And so we get these odd organisms coming to life all of a sudden under all of this, and part of this is the respiratory distress that was described for Florida, and it's the water quality problems, which is mostly a phosphorus issue in Lake Erie. And we have hundreds of beaches in Iowa which are not swimmable in the summer. And so it's something we all hold in common, which is that we'd like to have a high-quality environment, or at least a moderate-quality environment. And it's something to strive for amidst these very nuanced support levels, or ones that don't support it. We have loan applications which are dependent upon practices, not new ones that might change.
Right. And let me just stop and explain that a second, because as a farmer gets ready to farm for the next season and is going to buy crop insurance, they're very much locked into what they did the year before if they want the insurance. Is that not correct?
That's my understanding of it,
yeah. Yeah.
And including getting loans if you inherit it as well. If you want to pay for a new land or to inherit the land and you want to start farming on it, you may have to get a loan. And those are conditioned by the legacy effects.
Yeah. Let me take a couple more calls. Ross is calling from Aberdeen, South Dakota. Ross?
Hi, Harry. My family grew up, we were working cow-calf operations in central and western South Dakota, very hilly country. And I'm in my early 30s, and land that 25 years ago was all pasture land has been torn up into wheat fields. And with the hills and things that are in that area, all the drainage just comes right down into the Missouri River. Even in the Missouri River, we have small algae blooms. And definitely in the small lakes in the region, we have green algae blooms that sport fishing, once you get to July and it heats up to a certain point, there's no sport fishing even on some of these small lakes.
Boy, we've really hit a lot of different geographic areas. Ross, thank you very much for your call. Brad is calling from Fountain, Minnesota. Brad, how you doing today?
Hi, Harry. Yeah, I was just calling you to ask a question about who is responsible or how to fix these different problems. And I just had the thought, you know, that it's not necessarily just like the legislature or having to deal with the farm bill, but, you know, it's a lot of different aspects that are all tied together, because, you know, you have the farm bill where they get payments based on their corn base or their soybean base, and so that's a fixed amount that they get every year, you know, which is essentially coming out of taxpayer dollars. So in a sense, the whole country's paying for this problem. And then the other point I wanted to bring up was the crop insurance. You know, they take out subsidized crop insurance where the government's paying 50%, 60%, 70%, depending on how they go about it, of the premiums. And then if they don't get planted, they get paid on those acres. And if they get washed out or hailed out or something, they still get paid for that crop based on that crop insurance. So either way, they're making money. You know, it's just, I think what really happens, what it boils down to, is you just got to somehow fix the system. Because even with that crop insurance, there's no conservation practices that are tied into those payments.
Seems like there's an incentive missing in there, yeah. All right,
yeah.
Brett, yeah, thanks very much.
Yeah.
Art, I'm thinking just some of the tone of the last couple of conversations and listening to the tone of what we've been talking about over the last hour, some of the farmers I know would just, if they were listening, their dander would be up right now. They would just like, this is, it's not us. This is more complicated, and just don't blame the farmer. Is it possible that the system is at fault?
Well, yeah, you know, we're telling a 63-year-old farmer who's been told to plant fence row to fence row since Earl Butz was Secretary of Agriculture, it's our duty to feed the world, even though the world doesn't want our soybeans. China doesn't, apparently. And so we've been taught this for, 60 years, and now we're being told, no, this is a huge problem. We've got to, turn this rig around. And we can turn this rig around, but faced against that, these huge corporate interests chemicals in Iowa are a huge multi-billion-dollar industry. And so it really does take something as big as those economic forces to turn it around. We need more cattle. We need more grass. We need less corn, about 30% less corn in Iowa. And that's heresy, I understand. But that's coming from the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State, which has been defunded by the Iowa legislature in reaction to the Waterworks lawsuit.
Yeah.
I've also written a book about all this.
And I'm going to plug your book in 2 seconds. I promise you, Art. Gene Turner, let me get this in very quickly. I was talking to an agronomist at Iowa State last year. And I said, well, where's the best land in Iowa? And she said, Louisiana.
Well, depends what part of the land, I guess. The coastal wetlands have in 20 or 25% have been lost. And part of the reason is, and is going to be, as they try to restore them, they're going to add more, some of these nitrates and phosphates to the wetlands. And just like in Iowa, the deep-rooted plants go to shallow-rooted plants when you add nutrients, and then they become weaker soils, and they disappear with hurricanes. So that's another thing we have in common here that I've learned from the farming community, is that you have to. It's a very nuanced, interactive system, and there are more people in Chicago than there are in Iowa, and we have to work on everybody's understanding of this because it's local, it's national, it's statewide. It's a very complex problem, I admit, but that doesn't mean we can't do something about it.
Gene Turner, professor of oceanography and coastal sciences at Louisiana State University. So glad you took the time to be with us today. I think it is your wife, if I'm not mistaken, who discovered the dead zone in the first place. We want to thank her for that, too.
And she's sorry she can't be here.
Thanks so much, Gene. And Art Cullen, Pulitzer Prize-winning editor of the Storm Lake Times, has a book coming out this fall. I've got an advance uncorrected proof. It is must reading, and it is a great read. Storm Lake, a chronicle of change, resilience, and hope from a Heartland newspaper. Art, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. Appreciate it, sir.
You're a literate man, Harry. Thank you.
Central College, 1973. All right, pal. Thank you to all of our guests and our callers and the people who contributed online. You can continue the conversation and get On Point Podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. To the folks here at On Point, thank you for making me feel so at home. Appreciate all the help. I'm Harry Smith from NBC News. This is On Point.